Conductorless but not leaderless, the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra, all leaders, playing the Symphony No. 78 by Haydn.
You are listening to WHFR Dearborn here at Henry Ford Community College. I'm Susan McGraw, WHFR General Manager, and I would like to offer you the opportunity to get involved with WHFR in perhaps a more professional manner. We call it underwriting, and it's a way for your business or organization to show your support of the great programming that we present here on our non-commercial radio station. Underwriting is a win-win situation. It's tax deductible. It is a great opportunity to get the word out about your business, about your organization, to people that truly care, people that are passionate and committed to non-commercial programming. And we know we've got a great audience, and you're one of them, aren't you? So if you'd like to learn more about underwriting, give me a call anytime. Susan McGraw, WHFR GM. The number, 313-845-9842. Again, 845-9842. Hope to hear from you.
You're listening to WHFR Dearborn, non-commercial radio from Henry Ford Community College.
Good morning. You are listening to Then and Now, presented on WHFR Dearborn from 10 to 11 a.m. and the fourth Saturday of every month as a part of the WHFR Forum, our weekly talk show format. Then and Now is a pre-recorded program on WHFR at 89.3 FM, Making Waves, that primarily deals with how history affects current events. And now to our host, Ned Apigian, with today's program. Ned?
Thank you, Melissa.
Well, good morning. Our program today is part two of our two-part presentation we began in January, entitled The History of the Development of Socialism and Communism in the 18th and 19th Centuries. Part one was devoted to the philosophical development of socialism and eventually communism in and through the 19th century. Part two today is the history and of the Bolshevik movement at the turn of the 20th century in Russia and its subsequent development in Russia for the next 50 years, at least through World War II and beyond. Our guest today is, again, Ronald G. Suni. And thank you, Ronald, for coming.
Thank you for having me.
I really appreciate it because you are the specialist people need to hear. Anyway, I am going to read a short and edited version of his very long biography, and I hope he's not upset with me, but otherwise we'd be taking the whole program to read it. Now, if I can find page one and not get it mixed up with page two, I'll be all right. Okay, Ronald Gregor Suni is the Charles Tilly Collegiate Professor of Social and Political History at the University of Michigan and Professor Emeritus of Political Science and History at the University of Chicago. Ronald is a graduate of Swarthmore College and Columbia University. He taught at Oberlin College as a visiting professor of history and at the University of California, Irvine, and Stanford University. He is the author of Baku, the Commune, the Baku Commune, 1917 through 1918, and Nationalities in the Russian Revolution, Armenia in the 20th Century, The Making of the Georgian Nation, The Revenge of the Past, Nationalism, Revolution, and the Collapse of the Soviet Union, The Soviet Experiment, Russia, the USSR, and the Successor States. He's also the editor of Transcaucasia, Nationalism and Social Change, Essays in the History of Armenia, Azerbaijan, Georgia. He is also co-editor of Party, State, and Society in the Russian Civil War, The Russian Revolution and Bolshevik Victory, Empire and Nation, Making of the Age of Lenin and Stalin, which we're going to talk about today. He is currently working on 2-volume biography of Joseph Stalin at the Oxford University Press. And give me a chance to switch hands. And he was elected president of the American Association of the Advancement of Slavic Studies in 2006, and he has appeared numerous times on McNear Lehrer NewsHour, and he's blessing us with his presence today. The CBS Evening News, CNN, National Public Radio, has written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, The Nation, New Left Review, Dissent, and other newspapers and journals. You can see he's gracing us with his talent today, and you should all appreciate it. Professor Suni's intellectual interests have centered on the non-Russian nationalities of the Russian Empire and the Soviet Union, particularly those of the South Caucasus, Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Georgia. His aim has been to consider the history of Imperial Russia and the USSR without leaving out the non-Russian half of that great population of the former Soviet Union. Ronald, it's a pleasure to have you. I hope our audience appreciates the significance of your presence here today, and I know we're all going to learn a great deal. Anyway, we are here pre-recorded on Saturday, so please, audience, don't try to call us because this program is pre-recorded. And Ronald, we're going to begin at the 20th century where we left off, and that is the development of these movements and up to, say, 1900 to the 1905 revolutions in Russia. You might want to explain these movements, what they have to do with socialism or communism or the Bolshevik movement. And we're going to go, as we've spoke, from 1905 to pre-World War I. And I'll let you begin at the turn of the century, and I'll interrupt you when I want to go to the next phase if we're running out of time. Thank you. 1900.
Ned, please, Ned, you interrupt me because professors get to talk, and then they talk usually for 50 minutes straight. So
no.
when you get tired of what I'm saying or something isn't clear, you just tell me, okay?
I think 2 or 3 sentences on all the topics that we mentioned on the telephone should cover it very
right.
Well.
Well, anyway. let's say you were a traveler in Russia in 1900. This would be, as it is even today, the largest country in the world. Russia stretched all the way from Poland. Much of Poland was part of the Russian Empire at the time. Finland, Armenia, of course, part of Armenia, all the way through the Urals into Siberia. Are you there?
Yeah, well, we got a little... Something strange happened, but you can continue.
Okay.
We straightened it.
Russia is the largest country in the world, and it stretches from Poland all the way to the Pacific Ocean. It was ruled by an autocrat, an emperor. So Russia was a non-democratic state. It was an autocracy. That means it was ruled by one man with the aristocracy. 80-some percent of the population were peasants, poor peasants, and a small working class. And, of course, the small educated class in Russia, you know, various intellectuals and some of the noblemen and the middle class, etc., were interested in improving Russia and, in fact, were going to work very hard to make Russia more like a developed European country, maybe a constitutional monarchy, maybe a republic, and for many of the more radical intellectuals, a socialist state eventually. So around 1900, there was a small, radical, but quite influential intellectual group who developed various political parties and tried to agitate among the workers and the peasants. Those who favored the peasants, those who thought we can create a peasant socialist revolution, were called populists, or in Russian, narodniki. And they wanted to build a socialism based on the very egalitarian peasant commune, the peasant village. But growing in importance in the 1890s and around 1900 and in the next decade were the Marxist movement, which was called at the time social democracy. And in that movement were a number of people who had formerly been populists, and one most particularly interesting to us is this young man from the Volga region, actually a hereditary noble, though probably the greatest class traitor in history, Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov, who took the pen name that he's known to the world, Lenin. And Lenin was very radical at the time. He was very antagonistic to the Tsarist government. His brother had been a populist, had been involved in a plot to assassinate the Tsar, Alexander III, and had been hanged. And so Lenin had an enormous amount of bitterness, but his dedication was to develop a revolutionary consciousness, a socialist consciousness in the working class, that then could overthrow the government and establish first and foremost, a democratic state, because they thought Russia was so backward that it wasn't ready for socialism. So Lenin, around 1900, he and his comrades founded a newspaper called in Russian Iskra, which means the spark, very telling name, because it was supposed to spark interest in socialism and the revolution.
Obviously a fire.
a big fire, right. So this paper became the kind of nucleus of the reformation of a Marxist party called the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party. And in 1902, Lenin published a famous pamphlet called What is to be Done, in which he outlined what the movement should be doing. And in that pamphlet, a very influential pamphlet, he said, we need a party that in fact is a lot like an army, in which a small group at the top of intellectuals and hopefully some workers as well, conscious, politically knowledgeable social democrats, will bring the ideas of socialism to the workers. Because the workers left by themselves can't really develop a true socialist and revolutionary consciousness, Lenin thought. They know they're exploited, but they might settle for just more of the goodies of capitalism, rather than try to overthrow it.
In his pamphlet, did he talk about the Marxism and Marx in the 19th century?
Yes. Well, that was almost taken for granted.
Okay.
That is, all the Marxists believed that history was on their side, that it was evolving, from you know, more peasant-based, what they would have called feudal economy, into an industrial capitalist economy, that eventually the industrial capitalist economy would produce its own contradictions, and that the major contradiction would be the exploited working class, which Marxists called the proletariat.
However, I understand that the 1905 revolution was not a manifestation of their work. How does that figure in on their work?
Well, in the 1890s and the 1900s, industry did develop in Russia quite rapidly, and a small working class developed, quite discontented in many ways because of the ups and downs of the boom and bust cycle. And by 1904, 1905, there was much discontent among workers and among some peasants as well, in part because of the downturn in the economy, in part because of the agitation of these social democrats, their propaganda and so forth, and in part because Russia was losing and lost a war against Japan, the so-called Russo-Japanese War.
1905 as well.
Right, 1904, 1905. And so in January of 1905, many Russian workers, led by a priest, by the way, the social the Leninists didn't have much to do with this, led by a priest, marched singing God Save the Tsar to the palace of the Tsar to petition for relief, for some benefits, for some rights. And the Tsar's army, instead of receiving these petitions, shot into the crowd, killing many people. The blood ran in the snow, and this was called Bloody Sunday. And the myth of the Tsar as a benevolent father to his people, the Tsar Batushka, the little father Tsar, dissipated rapidly as people saw how cruel this regime could be. And then 1905 is a funny kind of revolution. It's really a bunch of strikes and mutinies and demonstrations and sometimes open warfare between peasants and the police that occur all through the year 1905. And because the Tsarist government was so bogged down in its war in Japan, which in 1905 finally came to an end, and they had to sign a humiliating peace, by the way, brokered by President Teddy Roosevelt.
Yeah, our own President Roosevelt.
Yeah, at Portsmouth, New Hampshire. He got a Nobel Peace Prize for that, by the way. Despite the fact that the war was over, the crowds in the streets were really protesting against the Tsar, and they wanted rights, etc. And they forced the Tsar in October 1905 to give them a kind of constitution.
The Duma.
And then they gave them a little parliament called the Duma, and they gave them the right to form unions, to speak openly, to have these elections, and freedom of the press, etc.
Okay, hang on to your thought. Let me make a station, and let's let our audience know what's going on for those who may have tuned us in before our beginning. You are listening to Then and Now, which is a program on how history affects current events. And we are broadcasting from the Henry Ford Community College here on WHFR 89.3 FM on your dial, and making waves is what we say we're doing here. And this program is pre-recorded, so those of you who are listening, please don't call because we're not there. So let's move on from 1905 to 1915 prior to what's going on in this period of 10 years. Where does the term Bolshevik, Menshevik derive from these social democrats?
Okay. Well, in 1903, we have to step back a moment here.
Okay.
The party, all the social democrats of Russia elected their delegates, and they had a Congress in London. Obviously, you couldn't have it in Russia since Russia was a kind of police state. So they had this Congress, and the Congress is supposed to unify the party. But in fact, it divided into two wings. A more radical wing, which was called the Bolsheviks, or the majority, and the Mensheviks, the minority, which was a more moderate wing. And they were both members of the same party, but they fought each other tooth and nail.
I understand.
Sort of like Obama and Clinton right now.
Right.
You know, two members of the same party, but each side had its own vision of what it wanted to do in the future.
later on, the Bolsheviks had the same problem with Trotsky and Stalin.
Right, right. So. They have all the, that's the
hopefully
nature
we'll get
of the
to
left.
That, too.
The nature of the left is always to split up into other groups. Anyway, these two groups both fought with each other and sometimes cooperated with each other. In 1905, the Mensheviks became more radical temporarily when the revolution was on, and he and the Mensheviks and Lenin, Lenin being the leader of the Bolsheviks, of course, cooperated for a while. But after the revolution of 1905, the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks had two different views. The Bolsheviks said, we didn't go far enough, we didn't arm the workers, we didn't try hard enough to make a revolution. And the Mensheviks said just the opposite. No, they said, we went too far, and what we did was bring down the wrath of the government and the middle class, and now there's a reaction. And of course, in 1905, by the end of 1905, the Tsarist government, now that the war was over, was able to bring its troops home and to crush the revolution.
Oh, so it took some time.
Enter a period now, from late 1905, right through almost to the war, of what can be called a reactionary period, in which, yes, there's a Duma, there's a parliament, but no agreement, no real
change.
Advances can be made through this democratic process.
Presumably the Tsar had a veto?
The Tsar had a veto, and ultimately he even changed the election law, so he got most of his own friends and followers and supporters to be in the Duma. So the left and the liberals and all of those people were sort of discontent. And that lasts almost up to the war. At the very eve of the war, there is revolutionary agitation and strikes occurring again. Then the war came in 1914.
Did that unify the state?
Absolutely. The war often
does.
As we know, unifies people. People become patriotic. They become jingoistic. They march. They listen to the music of the bands and the flags flying, and they all marched off to fight the Germans and the Austrians.
What happened to change things from 1915? They had too many losses.
Exactly.
Tannenbaum.
Exactly. Point is, people love a war if they're winning it. They don't like it particularly when they're losing it. Think about
it's the
Iraq.
Same problem we're having today, right?
Right.
They would love this war if they were winning it, but not if they
not
lose,
if you're
losing it.
No, right. Nobody likes a loser. So the war, Russians were losing tens of thousands of men. The army wasn't well supplied. What the Tsar had done, of course, was mobilize millions of peasants into uniforms and arm them, and now they were becoming discontent. So now you had peasants in uniform who wanted nothing more than to go home and farm their own land. And you had many people sort of voting with their feet eventually, leaving the front and going back.
Is it the large loss at this particular battle? Was that Tannenbaum battle?
Tannenbaum was one of them. That was
there
huge
others?
Loss. Yeah. And the Germans did very well. The Russians did better against the Turks. And they invaded Armenia, that. Turkish Armenia. They took the city of Van. They did okay against the Austrians. They took over Austrian Poland. Galicia occupied that for a while.
Oh.
But ultimately, the discontent with the war, with the economy, etc., led to the outbreak of a revolution. It's very interesting how that revolution broke out.
Is it because they didn't have enough to eat? Was there starvation and problems like that?
That's part of it. In fact, the very first thing was women going out on the street and calling for bread.
I see.
And then the women went to the factories and they shamed the men. And they said, where are you? Come out. So men, workers, came out on the street. And then the final blow was when these workers and women demonstrated, the soldiers ultimately refused to fire on them. And so suddenly, instead of a government backed by soldiers, you had soldiers joining the crowd. And the government fell very quickly. The Tsar was basically imprisoned or exiled.
Well, he was on his way home or something in a train, and they made him...
They made him abdicate.
Abdicate.
Exactly right. Oh. And so a government comes to power, a new government.
Kerensky's government, or does it take a while before that happens?
No, well, eventually Kerensky will be the leader of that government.
I see.
He's in the government at first, and then
he
becomes the prime
minister. Is this the so-called provisional government?
Exactly, yeah. The provisional government was made up of middle and upper class people, largely. And it was recognized by the great powers as the government of Russia. But at the very same time that the provisional government was formed, the workers and soldiers, a little bit suspicious of this middle class government, formed their own councils. And the word for council in Russian
is Soviet.
So the Soviets of workers and soldiers' deputies were a kind of counter-government to the provisional government. The way you can say it is that the provisional government had formal power, but the Soviet had real power, because the Soviet could actually call workers out and tell them to go work in the factories, or call the soldiers out and tell them to fight.
What if it was a coalition of other than soldiers? Would it still have been called Soviets, or would that's irrelevant?
Soviet just means council.
Right.
So you had workers' councils, peasants' councils, you had soldiers' councils, and eventually the soldiers and the workers and even the peasants joined together.
So how long was the provisional government quickly, and how long was the Kerensky government that decided to continue with the war, which brought the Bolsheviks in, presumably?
Right. The provisional government lasts roughly from March 1917 until it's overthrown by the Bolsheviks in October 1917.
So that's the famous October Revolution?
That's the famous October Revolution, which is based on the Soviets. So the Soviets, led
right.
by the Bolsheviks now, very radical, very discontent with the provisional government, which was continuing the war and which wasn't solving the economic problems. The Soviets, led by the Bolsheviks, led by Lenin, overthrew the provisional government, and Kerensky was forced to flee.
When is the story of this Aurora battleship firing on the palace? This is before the abdication?
This is exactly in October.
In October when
the
Bolshevik,
it's the Bolshevik Revolution.
Okay, so I hit it right on the nail head at the right time. Since I didn't know exactly what I was talking about, it's not bad.
That ship is still available for tourists to walk on and visit in Petersburg, so you can make a vacation and go to Russia and
I
see that.
I certainly would visit it if I go. That's
right.
Sure. So October, they say, was a revolution that happened almost bloodlessly, and it was done without much effort, everybody keeps saying. It was done very easily.
That's true in one sense. That is, the actual October days, there weren't many people killed, and the Kerensky government fell very easily, and the Bolsheviks took over. But the very act of seizing power by the Bolsheviks encouraged other forces to organize against this new socialist government. And there you get what we call the whites, monarchists, and some middle-class elements, liberals, as conservatives.
How long did that take to develop after October 1917?
Almost immediately. That
Almost
is,
immediate.
In the first days of the new government, already there's resistance. Already the British and the French are supplying arms and money to these people to overthrow the Bolsheviks.
There's one thing we need to share with our audience, that the provisional government and subsequently the Kerensky government advocated for continuing to fight the war, where the Bolsheviks were indicating to get out of the war.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah.
So that made a difference. So now We've reached, when does the Bolshevik government decide to make a peace with Germany? What month was that Treaty of Brest-Litovsk?
In March of 1918.
So March, that's quite some time has passed now from October 1917.
Right, they immediately declared that they wanted an armistice.
I see.
And in December they already had an armistice. Some Bolsheviks were not happy with that, making treaties and so forth with imperial powers, and the Germans were occupying parts of Russia. But Lenin was a very practical man. He realized that Russia had no army anymore, that people were voting with their feet, leaving the front.
And in Turkey, of course, the army retreated from Turkey back there. Other words, today, I don't think the average person knows, the boundary between the Soviet Russia and today Armenia and Turkey is greatly the idea of the retreat of the Russian army to that point. In other words, the old Russian Tsarist border between Turkey and Russia is considerably different today than it was.
The Tsarist border of 1828 is roughly the border that we have today between Armenia and Turkey.
Oh, really?
But the but in 1877-78,
oh, the 1876 war, yeah.
Russia increased its hold on Turkey and had other cities like the big fortress town of Kars, and they held that until 1918. But in 1918, with Brest-Litovsk, they gave up
all of
that territory.
So they were going back to 1829, essentially.
Yeah, 1828, yeah.
Okay, so now we have the establishment of the Soviet state. What can we say about the White and Red Revolution, Civil War, a period up until its conclusion is what, 1922 officially?
Yeah, 21, 22, you could say. So for the first 4 or 5 years...
What did that bring out, for example? It brought the Western powers after World War I involved in the White and Red, the American intervention, the British, the French. Why don't you tell us something about that? The average person doesn't know much about that period. And that's the reason why the Soviets were very anti-West for the longest time and were suspicious of us.
The Bolsheviks from day one were faced by opposition. The Bolsheviks were a minority party in Russia. They had control of many of the big cities, so they had working class support, and they had much soldier support because they were dedicated to ending the war. So, but they were certainly not a majority. And when in November, December, there were elections to a constituent assembly, something like our constitutional convention, the Bolsheviks didn't win. They got something over a quarter of the votes. And the largest party, as you would expect in a peasant country, were the peasant parties, the socialist revolutionaries. But the Bolsheviks had power. They had the Soviets and they had the army. So they were getting it. They were not.
We're talking about the period of the Duma. Is that correct?
No, we're talking now about the period of the Soviet government after October 1918.
Oh, they actually had maintained a parliament and had a form of democracy as well.
They had elections to what was called the Constituent Assembly.
I see. Okay, that's...
It was a relatively democratic election, and the Bolsheviks lost that.
Even though...
right?
I guess.
And that assembly met in January 1918 for one day, but Lenin decided that assembly was a competitor to Soviet power.
Absolutely,
It wouldn't recognize Soviet power. And so he dissolved it and didn't let them meet again.
And had the power to do that because of the military advantage they had.
Right. Okay. Lenin's view is a revolution is not an election campaign.
Yeah, obviously.
It's a war. And it's a matter of what forces you have with guns in the right place. And so basically they then fought for the next 3 or 4 years against monarchists, Democrats, moderate socialists, foreign interventionists, Americans from Michigan. By the way, there was a Michigan brigade in the north of Russia fighting against the Bolsheviks. All kinds of people, peasant parties, anarchists, nationalists.
So this is the period of so-called White and Red War, Civil War.
This is a Civil War.
Begins when? With the...
Roughly 1917, 1918, and lasts until 1921, 1922. And ultimately, at the end of that long struggle, the Bolsheviks come out on top. The foreigners retreat. The whites leave and go to Paris to open restaurants.
Yeah.
The peasants are crushed, and they ultimately make a deal with the Bolsheviks. And then the Soviets begin to create their own new state.
Okay, let's stop at that point. The Russian Civil War has been won by the Reds. And everyone needs to see that picture of Warren Beatty, the Reds. I don't know what you think about that.
Oh, it's excellent.
You liked it? I liked it. It's kind of long, but it was nice.
Yeah.
Anyway, what we're listening to today is our guest, Ronald Suny, who's a professor at the University of Michigan of History. I am your host, Ned Apigian, and I am hosting a program called Then and Now, which is a program that once a month illustrates how current events are affected by history. And if you don't understand what's going on today, you'll never know until you know something about what happened in the past. what's happened to the Soviet Union is a little passé now since its disillusionment in 1991, but this story is awful interesting. So we are on WHFR 89.3, making waves from the radio station of the Henry Ford Community College right here in Dearborn, Michigan. So now we have Lenin. Lenin, after the war, how much time does he have for doing planning what he's planning before he passes? I think he passed in 1924, which is a year or two after the conclusion of the Civil War, and then we have the development of Stalin. How different, in your opinion, would things have been if Lenin continued to live and Stalin didn't happen?
Much different. Winston Churchill once said, the second worst thing that ever happened to Russia was Lenin's death. Of course, he felt that the first worst thing that had happened to Russia was Lenin's birth.
Right.
But Lenin was a different kind of leader from Stalin.
Didn't he say something about chasing a chicken in the barnyard or something? You had to get that chicken and wring its neck?
That I don't know about.
It was something like that.
That one I don't know. In any case, Lenin was, a Marxist. He was a man who was not a Western Democrat. He believed in what we call the dictatorship of the proletariat. He believed that the Bolshevik Party...
You explained that one time, the meaning of that, which was a very good definition in part one.
Mm. He believed in ultimately crushing the opposition, getting rid of oppositional parties. He was always afraid that if there was division in the party or division among parties, that the Soviets could be overthrown and capitalism could be restored. So he was worried about that. So basically, Lenin established a one-party state, a very effective one, that was run by a small group of men at the top, a kind of oligarchy, with him as the most powerful leader. But Lenin was never a sole dictator. Lenin was, what they say, primus inter pares, that is, the first among more or less equals. There were dissents, there were discussion. So you could really say that was an oligarchic form of government. And that lasted for another 10 years, let's say, after Lenin's death. But through those years, through the 20s and the early 30s, power began to gravitate to a smaller and smaller number of people, to one faction within the party, and that faction was led by this Georgian Social Democrat, Joseph Stalin, who ultimately, in the 1930s, largely because he used violence and terror against communists, against his mates, killing most of Lenin's friends and comrades.
I thought he consolidated his presence as secretary of the Communist Party by 1928. That's about 4 years after Lenin's death.
Well, by 1928, he's certainly the most important of the Bolsheviks, but he's not yet a single dictator. That takes a little more time.
He eliminates all his rivals
right
up to that period.
And that he does in the purges.
I see. Now, isn't the first five-year plan begun in 1928?
Yeah, that's right. 1928, you could say, is the time of the Stalin Revolution. Lenin had a more compromising policy, which he established in 1921, which was called the New Economic Policy, or NEP, and it was a kind of state capitalism. So there were markets. Peasants could grow their own food.
Something like what we got in China today, right?
Almost exactly, yeah. It's a kind of state capitalism, as in China, half private and half state.
I think in 17th century France, they called it mercantilism.
Something like that. In any case, this system got into some trouble by the end of the 20s, and Stalin turned radically against it, and launched his own state policy, which was forced collectivization of the peasantry, that is, pushing the peasants into collective farms, taking their grain away from them by force, getting rid of the most productive peasants called kulaks, and then rapid industrialization, taking capital out of the countryside and investing it in the development of industry.
Didn't the industrialization begin in 1928 as well, or did it wait till the early 30s? I thought
no. Roughly, the first 5-year plan is 1928 to, let's say, 1932. Yeah,
I see. Now, so when is it that you feel that Stalin becomes the ultimate dictator? What year is that? 1932.
I think historians differ on that, you know, and it's a matter of what you actually mean. Because certainly by 1930-31, he's clearly the most powerful person in the Soviet Union.
Who was that very popular person that he had killed? Kirov? That was.
Well, Kirov was very popular, and Kirov was a loyal Stalinist. And Stalin was not involved in his death, though he exploited that death. Some historians actually believe that he had Kirov knocked off, but most others believe that that's not true. The one very popular one that the great supporter of NEP, of the moderate state capitalist policy, was Nikolai Bukharin. And that one, that guy...
He was always around that guy with the beard for years and years. Am I getting the right guy?
And Bukharin was a favorite of the party. Lenin loved him. He was a comrade of Stalin. Stalin worked with him in the mid-20s. Then he turned against it when Stalin decided to launch his own revolution of now ending the markets and creating a state-run economy in the late 20s and early 30s, Bukharin was thrown out, and eventually he was tried and he was shot.
Let's talk about the important difference of this argument between Trotsky and Stalin. Stalin wanted to consolidate power in the Soviet Union. Trotsky wanted to export revolution until they threw him out of the country in 1939, was it, or 38? Why don't you talk about this difference between the two of them? Average people don't know much about that. Most of the revolutionaries in the war are looking to Trotsky as their guiding light in the 40s and what have you, right?
Well,
could you explain that?
Trotsky had not been a Bolshevik until 1917. But Lenin recognized his qualities. He was a great orator. He was a good organizer. He was a brilliant theoretician. He's a wonderful writer. And so when Trotsky moved politically toward Lenin in 1917, Lenin was very happy to take him into the party.
And he supposedly won the White-Red Civil War.
And in fact, Trotsky was the Commissar of War and formed the 5 million man Red Army and helped win the Civil War, absolutely. So many people thought Trotsky would be the natural successor to Lenin.
Heir apparent.
Right. But other Bolsheviks didn't like him. They saw him as an upstart. They saw him as a man on a white horse. They were afraid of him. He was a very arrogant fellow. There are a lot of personal qualities.
He's always Jewish, too, wasn't he?
And he was Jewish. But then many of the top Bolsheviks were Jewish.
Hmm.
So that
wasn't exceptional.
That wasn't exceptional, nor much of a concern at the time. Because they played down ethnicity. They were not interested in ethnicity.
And he obviously was a secular Jew, wasn't a practicing one.
Right. So right as Lenin was getting ill, 1922-1923, a group of Bolsheviks, Stalin, Zinoviev, and Kamenev, formed a little cabal called a triumvirate to attack Trotsky and to keep Trotsky off balance. And once Lenin died, basically this group of people in the top party organization, the top party committee called the Politburo, basically isolated Trotsky. And then, step by step, they chipped away at his power. They removed him in 1925 from the Commissariat of War. He was seen as an oppositionist, as against the general line, the central line of the party, and eventually he was exiled.
What happened between that time until he was exiled? What was the reason for exiling?
Well, he was considered to be a factionalist, a divider, an oppositionist, and not conforming to the general line of the party, which, of course, was Stalin's position.
Okay, now, during this period of the 30s, where we have industrialization, which, you know, took the Soviet Union from almost nothing to something, then they got involved in the Spanish Civil War. And then later, they were anti-fascists. And later, In 1939, we want to move this along a little bit. Hitler offers him a pact and shocks all the leftists in the world. What period did they seem to be strong enough to start being concerned with the Spanish Civil War supplying them? What was their philosophical outlook on that, since Trotsky was the internationalist, so Stalin wasn't? Can you say something about that?
Well, if you want to sort of generalize about Stalin's position in the 1930s, in terms of foreign policy and communist international policy, you'd have to say that his first concern was state security, was the security and well-being of the Soviet Union. Stalin was aware that a war was coming, probably with first they thought England and France, but then later with Nazi Germany. And so the country had to be built up in order not to be again attacked, again defeated. And industrialization was part of that. He and probably himself also saw the purges and crushing the party and purging the army even as part of the strengthening of the state, though in fact it actually weakened the state. Also in foreign policy, he tried a number of different things. First, they talked actively, say, from 1928 to early 1930s, of overthrowing bourgeois imperialist states. Then they turned and realized that fascism is a danger, and they had to join with Britain and France and other capitalist states and form what they called the Popular Front against the fascists, who were the real danger. Then, when Britain and France seemed reluctant to make any kind of real agreement with the Soviet Union, when they gave in to Hitler at Munich in 1938, Stalin said, you know, these are not people I can depend on. And he made another switch and said, I'll deal with Hitler. And so
But he was trying to buy time, presumably.
Yeah, in 1939, August 1939, on the eve of World War II.
7 days before the war,
right,
as I understand.
He made a pact with Hitler, which, of course, destroyed the international communist movement, because these were guys who had been dedicated to fighting the fascists, and overnight they had to then collaborate with them and attack the democratic powers.
Now, war with Finland, in order to increase his border space to protect the Soviet Union from Germany, turned out to be a mistake to expand. I think he realized there might be a war, so that's what he engaged into Finland and moved into the Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, is my understanding.
That's exactly right.
I didn't realize that those three states were still quasi-independent up until that period from World War One. Their status.
All those states, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, and Finland, had all been part of the Russian Empire up to 1918. Then, as a result of the weakness of the Bolshevik Party and the movements of the Germans and so forth, they became independent from 1918 to the Second World War. And Stalin wanted to improve his defensive position there, so he did a number of things. He fought a short war with Finland, first very disastrous for the Soviet Union.
After he had had the purges of the Red Army,
right,
and he couldn't pull it off.
And then, of course, they did defeat Finland. I mean, Russia against Finland is not a fair fight. And the Finns gave up certain territory, and they were very upset, and eventually they went over to the Germans.
During World War II.
And invaded the Soviet Union, fought with Hitler against the Soviet Union. And then the small Baltic states, Stalin simply incorporated them in the Soviet Union, just took them over, annexed them, and, of course, claimed that it was all voluntary, which was not true.
Yeah, well, it's a quarter to the hour. I got to give another station ID. We want to cover Stalin's entry into the war. You're listening to Then and Now. Our guest today is Professor Ronald Suny, Professor of History at the University of Michigan, and I am Ned Apigian, your host on Then and Now, which is a program that tries to bring some light into current events are based on historical facts of the past. And you are listening to WHFR 89.3 FM on your radio dial. And those of you, our range is limited, but you can hear us on the internet at WHFR.FM, on the internet, and hopefully people can hear us around the world if those are in, that are know about it and are interested. Okay, now we're at the beginning of World War II. I understand from a program I watched the other day that Stalin had read Mein Kampf, and in Mein Kampf he explains how he once needs Russia, so he was buying time, and it takes the tragedy of he's attacked, and then the war changes everything. It increases Russia's power in the world. They become a second world power. Would you want to discuss the war quickly as to what it meant to all the peoples? Eventually, the Red Army conquered. And
well, I think you put it very well. The Soviet Union was an isolated, backward state that the West was extremely suspicious of. And then it fought the greatest war between two countries in the world, that is the Eastern Front of World War II, more men involved, more tanks, more airplanes than any other conflict in world history. The Soviets faced three-quarters of the Nazi forces, plus allies of the Nazis. Basically, not to take anything away from the greatest generation that Tom Brokaw talks about or the D-Day invasion.
Everybody thinks they won the Second World War.
Basically, the Soviets defeated the fascists. We
right.
defeated the Japanese, of course.
Right.
And we certainly helped the Soviets, that we gave them lend-lease, and eventually we, in 1944, we opened the Second Front, which they were grateful for, though unhappy it was delayed so long.
Well, I don't know why they didn't consider fighting the fascists in Africa as a Second Front. I don't know.
Yeah, well, it didn't.
It diverted Russians.
It didn't draw enough forces away, I guess.
I guess that's what the problem was.
So anyway, the Soviets then, of course, emerge from their isolation. Now they're a major global player. They're in Korea. They have allies in China with the communists.
So why didn't they just incorporate all of Eastern Europe into the Soviet Union?
Well,
that was tasteless?
No, what? I think there's a couple of reasons for that. I think, first of all, Stalin was had several interests. Right after the war...
Yeah, tell us something we obviously never heard. That's great.
Stalin wanted an alliance with the West. He wanted to keep the Grand Alliance. He needed aid from the West. He wanted reparations from Germany. He wanted loans from the United States. The Soviet Union was devastated.
I understand they turned down the Marshall Plan, though, when it was offered to them.
Well, for good reasons, yeah, because the Marshall Plan came not innocently. It came with conditions. If you wanted to be a part of the Marshall Plan, you had to have a free market capitalist economy, and you had to use the money to buy goods in the United States. So you know, Stalin would have had to dismantle the Stalinist economy.
I see.
And so he couldn't do that, and he forced the Czechs as well to conform to his way of doing things and to create a so-called socialist economy.
So you don't think what happened from... Is there a period from after the war to a certain date where there was a change in their thinking?
In whose thinking?
Stalin's thinking.
Yes, of course. The early years of the Cold War, Stalin wants two things. He wants, first of all, this Grand Alliance to continue. He needs it. But secondly, he's an old-fashioned realpolitik. He's an old sphere of influence kind of thinker, like Churchill. And he wants his own dominance over Eastern Europe. He wants to have some say in Finland, Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Romania, Yugoslavia, and so forth. He wants friendly governments there. And actually the West agreed that they would have friendly non-anti-communist governments in that area. But when that didn't happen, when some of these countries like Poland and Hungary elected other people who were not particularly pro-Soviet, and when the Truman Doctrine against communist subversion and the Marshall Plan in 1947 come out, Stalin realizes, there is no deal with America. I'm going my own way. I'm clamping down on these countries. I'm taking them over. And so we get the division of Europe.
Now, I understand when President Roosevelt went to Yalta, he agreed to some of the conditions of post-World War II, of giving the Eastern countries to under his influence, that they say Roosevelt was sick. And so These things were predetermined in Yalta, what the common belief is, too. What do you think about the Yalta agreements?
Well, there are a couple of different views on Yalta. Yalta was basically an agreement. First of all, remember, they're allies still. The war's not over.
Right.
And the Soviet,
Germany first.
Yeah. And they made concessions to Stalin to continue the war and so forth. And
but they asked for elections after the war, something which he didn't.
That's right. They wanted democratic elections. Particularly Truman was forceful on that. And ultimately, that's something that Stalin wouldn't tolerate, because those democratic elections in most of those East European countries would have led to governments that were anti-Soviet or not under his control.
Where did they find all these the communists in East Germany that were there in the 30s, went to Soviet Union? Is this the same for Czechs and the Hungarian leftists? Did they all pop out of Russia at the end of the war?
Well, once these countries became dictators or fascists or conquered by the Nazis, of course, many communists fled to Russia, right? But
right.
Many communists also were in these countries during the war. They were the core of
the opposition
resistance.
Right.
The resistance movement had many, many communists in it. Sometimes the resistance movement was communist-led.
I don't think that's a good point you bring out. I don't think most Americans realize, especially the movement in France, the Marquis, they're primarily leftists.
They're mostly all leftists, and some of them are actually communists. The one in Greece, there was a separate communist resistance movement.
And the one in Yugoslavia is well known. The
absolutely,
British,
yeah. And in Albania, yeah.
The British supported the Chetniks, and the Chetniks were slightly different than, I don't know.
They were nationalists, Serbian nationalists.
Serbian nationalists, and then the Croatians, as I understand it, sided with the Germans, and then also the Bosnians, the Muslims in Yugoslavia fought with the Germans as well. And most people think Hungary was an occupied country. They don't know that Hungary was an ally of Germany, and I think Romania was too, right?
For a good part of the war.
Yeah, I mean,
at
most people just don't really. Yeah, what was the Romanian general when the Russian army was at his doorstep, and then? But most people think that Germany occupied all those countries, and they were belligerents, and they weren't welcomed.
But no, many of them were friendly. Almost all the countries on the Soviet Union's western border were anti-Soviet, anti-communist, and very often pro-fascist, or certainly authoritarian dictatorships by the 1930s. So, this was an area that
Stalin... They were caught between two devils, and they had to decide which devil was better for them.
And this was an area that Stalin didn't want to have a third invasion come through in the 20th century. So
that's right.
This was his security zone, and he gave up the idea of the alliance with the West.
All right, so we got a couple minutes left, and so we're at the Cold War. And can you say something in wrapping up the program in the next 3 minutes or so that... Was there any kind of misunderstanding between what one group needed or wanted and what one was trying to preserve at that period, say, from 1948, after it was clear the Cold War began, Churchill made his speech in Fulton? Is there, from that period on to the dissolution of the Soviet Union, that period of... What are we talking about, 48 to 91, we're talking about 43 years or so? Is that period divided in any way that you see?
Well,
other than Gorbachev's period to try to make a humane socialist revolution in Russia?
No, obviously, once Stalin died in 1953...
Great, that's a good turning
the
point.
The full Stalinist system, complete with terror... Arbitrary arrest,
came to an end.
Now, many elements of Stalinism would continue. There'd still be collective farms and state plans and so forth. But and you still have the police, this powerful police. You still have censorship, but it's far a softer regime than it ever was under Stalin. And civil society began to develop more. It was possible to talk about things in different ways. People began to travel.
So when's the next period of difference? So you would say from 1953, Stalin's passing, until 1991 is almost 38 years. Does that period have a division in it?
Oh, yeah.
Gorbachev.
I would say that
another minute left.
So. I would say that there are two divisions. One, from 53 to roughly 64, they're ruled by Nikita Khrushchev.
Yes.
And that's a period of some reform, kind of conservative reform, never enough.
I understand. Okay,
then you
that's
have
great.
The period of Leonid Brezhnev from 64 up to 1982, and that's a period what will be called stagnation, less reform. And then Khrushchev comes to power, and you have then the radical reforms that ultimately led to the demise of the Soviet Union.
Well, Professor Suni, you've summed up the period up to the end of the Soviet Union perfectly on my time schedule. I think it's nice for people to think about those periods, 53 to 64, 64 to Gorbachev, and then all of us know pretty much that the system was a failure. It took Gorbachev to recognize it and try to change it. And I'd like to thank you very much for this very informative program. And I hope our listeners enjoyed it as much as I did. Thank you very much, Ronald.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
You're listening to WHFR Dearborn. We're bringing you non-commercial radio from Henry Ford Community College. Good morning. My name is Bill Keith, and it is a pleasure to be here with you. It's time for Light from the Underground, and we've got some great music lined up for you. I thought I'd start things off with something from Kelly Joe Phelps. This is the title cut from his album Roll Away the Stone, which was released back in 1997. Here it is on 89.3 WHFR.FM. We're making
only one more than yeah. All as I look out across a worn out plain. Only one more than yeah. All as I look out across a worn out plain. Dust Bowl memories, you can hear me shout. Dust Bowl memory, you can hear me shout. I wanna roll away the